Back chat.
Politics and current affairs.
Back chat.
Your alternative to talk back.
Proudly supported by the Judith Nielsen Institute.
It's Saturday, May 14th, and you're listening to Backchat, where we bring you the stories of Sydney and beyond. We're broadcasting from the Gadigal land of the Eora Nation and pay respects to elders past and present. My name's Tanita Rezaghi, and I'm joined today with Sana Sheikh. Sana, what do we have on the show today?
Hey, Tanita. Good morning. Today, we're going to be hearing from Bailey Linton Simpkins, one of the student organisers of last week's school strike for climate, which saw thousands of young people march through Sydney CBD demanding better climate action. And we're keeping up with our interviews with politicians as part of our election 2022 coverage here at Backchat. In a little while, we'll have Federal Green Senator Maureen Faruqi in the studio for a special interview. But to kick things off this morning, we'll be tracking the curious case of a Sydney congestion tax, which looked to be in the cards earlier this week, but it was shot down by Premier Dominic Perrottet.
And if any of that pricked your ears, then as always, get in touch. How could we improve congestion and transport issues in the city? You can text in on 0409 945 945 or tweet us at Backchat.
Backchat, Backtalk.
Now, most of us have been stuck in painful Sydney traffic, but how would you feel about being charged $20 or $10 to drive into the CBD at peak times? Early in the week, nine newspapers got on their hands on a leaked cabinet documents from the New South Wales state government, which revealed a congestion tax had been put to government.
Yeah, this was put forward along with a bunch of other suggestions aimed at improving traffic and congestion issues across Sydney. The thinking behind a congestion tax is that by handing over money for to drive into the CBD, it would limit how many people were driving into the city and at which times. So what's the story here? Backchat producer Eamon Snow is in the studio with us now to unpack this one. Hey, Eamon, thanks so much for joining us.
Good morning. Let's talk congestion. Come on.
Yeah. So, Eamon, London actually has something like this introduced back in 2003. Can you just run us through that?
Yeah. This isn't actually an original idea, which is probably better, I suppose, as an example of it. But yeah, drivers have to cough up around $25 when you do the conversion to enter London City Centre. They introduced that in 2003. 3 years later, data actually did show that it worked. In the charging zone, traffic was down 15%, and congestion, which is basically how much longer your trip is made because of traffic, dropped by 30%. And then data from more recent times, like 2018, shows that traffic volumes in London have dropped by about a quarter compared to 10 years prior, so 2008. So it's an interesting proposal. The government was put to the government. A lot of experts are actually saying it might be a good thing, but of course, we don't want to pay more. I mean, the one-off costs would be pretty expensive, but it is good to know that it wasn't just dreamt up by the government. There is an example of it. But despite all this, despite it being leaked earlier in the week, Dominic Perrottet came out pretty quickly and ruled it out. Hear what he had to say right now. Oh, there we go. We've got the tail end of Dominic Perrottet there. Basically, he just said we're ruling it out completely. They're not into it whatsoever. But it has raised some pretty interesting conversations around what we should be doing in Sydney to kind of address these issues. I think everyone out there has taken a trip through the CBD or even like not the CBD and dealt with some pretty serious traffic. We know it's getting worse. More people are moving to Sydney. There's only so many roads you can build. So what do you do?
Yeah, definitely. I feel like this with this congestion tax, it's quite frustrating because it puts the onus on the individual when I feel like we're already struggling so much with like poor public transport infrastructure. Right, Sana?
Yeah, I think that's a really important point. If the government's going to make people pay $10 or $20 to drive into the CBD, then they need to spend that money and invest it directly into public transport. Because I think the comparison between Sydney and London is that London has a much more sophisticated public transport network, whilst ours isn't on the same level. And so if we improve public transport, only then this kind of system would work.
Yeah, that's one of the things that sprung to mind for me. It's all well and good to propose this, but we know there's pretty glaring gaps in what Sydney offers in terms of public transport and also in terms of like cycling infrastructure, bike hire, bike rental, e-bike, all those kind of things that you do see overseas commonplace, we just don't seem to have yet. So if you were to chuck a tax on people, there's still a whole lot of people who are going to have to enter the city regardless because their options are limited. I mean, before the show, Tanita, you were talking about what a trip to Redfern would look like for you on a regular basis. And it's like, it's massive. And if you miss a train, you're stuffed.
Yeah, like it's walk to the bus stop, one bus every hour. If that bus sometimes doesn't come, then I have to take two trains and walk from the train station to work. And that is almost like a 2.5-3 hour round each way. And it's really hard for people that live on like the outskirts of Sydney to get into the CBD for like, you know, work and things like that. But something that I noticed was when I had family from overseas, especially from Europe, come, they were shocked at the amount of trucks that we had on the roads in the CBD. Like my cousin from Holland said that they don't have trucks that come in the city centre and that they have specific lanes that are designated for trucks because, you know, trucks do cause a lot of congestion. It's just like it's interesting to see how other countries do it. Like in New York as well, you can get those city bikes or electric bikes and you can pay a monthly membership and it's really like it's quite affordable and like manageable and it's a way to keep cars off the road really.
Yeah, it just seems like this is an issue where there should be more of a focus on urban planning to make our cities more walkable, more accessible via public transport, and so we don't have to rely on driving in. Thank you so much, Eamon, for coming on the show and chatting to us about that.
My pleasure, guys.
Don't go anywhere, because up next, we'll be chatting about a proposed policy to wipe student debt and make housing more accessible for all with the Green Senator, Maureen Faruqi.
Super exciting, but right now we've got music from Mike Acox. He's the first ever Afrobeat artist to come out of Australia, and this one's called Pumpkin. You're listening to FBI. Keep it locked. Baby, for your love,
I go spend all my paper. Yesterday was not my birthday, so you are wrong. My birthday was last month.
Back chat on FBI Radio.
Today is 7 days before Election Day, and we've got you covered with all the info you need to know before you vote on the 21st of May. And today we're going to be breaking down the policies from the Greens Party that matter to you most.
The Greens have released their policy platform for the federal election. There's some ambitious plans around housing, higher education, and even wiping student debt. To break this all down for us and explain what this means for you, we're joined by Senator for New South Wales from the Greens Party, Maureen Faruqi. Good morning, Maureen. Thanks for coming on Backchat today.
Yeah, good morning. It's so lovely to be here with you and in the studio.
Yeah, it's fantastic. So, Maureen, the Greens want to abolish all outstanding student debt and make uni and TAFE free for all. There's also a promise to give $1 billion to unis for research, and there'll be a 10% increase for each student. Will this be enough to make up for the deficit from the lack of tuition fees?
What we are seeing in universities is really a crisis situation, to be really frank, and it has been exacerbated during COVID. We know that in universities, you know, around 40,000 staff have been let go of over the last couple of years. We know that students are struggling. We know international students were left high and dry. Mm-hmm. So there has been attack after attack on universities in terms of funding freezes, funding cuts, casualization is rampant, and something needs to be done. And so what we're doing is making sure that education is seen as a right, not a privilege that people have to pay through their nose for. Everyone should be able to have education without coming up shackled with a huge debt sentence. And so the cost of, if you're talking about costs and how it'll be paid for, it's an investment. It's a huge investment. Wiping student debt will cost us $60 billion over a decade. But you know what? Stage 3 tax cuts that the government has pushed through with the support of the Labour Party, is $184 billion, which goes mainly into the pockets of the wealthiest in our country. Wiping student debt means that it will help relieve cost of living pressure for women, for young people, for those on low and middle income earners. So compare $60 billion to $184 billion. Actually, it's increased now. Stage 3 tax cuts and the cost of those has increased to $206 billion. Studies by the PBO, which is the Parliamentary Budget Office, analysis done by them, which is in the newspapers today, suggests that just in 1 year, the costs have blown out by $22 billion. So it's about priorities and where you want to invest. So if we get rid of, and the Greens are adamant that in the balance of power, that's what we're hoping to achieve after 21st May, we will push hard to get rid of stage three tax cuts. They are more than enough to pay for making UniEnte free and for wiping student debt.
Maureen, for years we've seen a researcher and academic exodus from Australia to other countries with more money for research. This has left a gaping hole in our tertiary education sector. Now, the Greens are proposing to invest $70 million per year for the Australian Research Council's Future Fellowship Scheme and $50 million per year for the Secure Work for Researchers Fund. Will this funding be enough to reverse the damage that's already done?
Well, funding is a big part of the picture. You know, research and universities in general have been starved of funding. But it is also things like interference in how research grants are given to universities. We have seen recently that the education minister has intervened and vetoed ARC grant applications which had gone through the peer-reviewed process. And that really has undermined trust in the research system. And that is one reason. You know, I've been talking to academics across the country, and they are telling us that it really undermines trust. And that is one of the reasons why, you know, our researchers are leaving and why others from other countries are not coming to Australia. So, of course, research funding is a big part of it, but there is also academic freedom. And that goes to the heart of how universities operate and our postgraduate students and researchers within them operate as well.
Absolutely. Now we just want to move to talk a little bit more about the housing policies. So the Greens want to build 1 million homes to tackle the housing crisis, but how will this work to improve things now when the plan is that these homes will be built over 20 years?
I've just come back from the Central West last night. I was in Dubbo and Orange. And the issue that came up most when I was speaking to the community was the housing crisis. I mean, we know that in Sydney, the median house price is $2.6 million. So it's no wonder that about 70% of young people say that they can't even dream of owning a home. Like, you know, their dreams have pretty much become nightmares. We know that we need 1 million homes over the next 2 decades to be able to meet the demand. So obviously they will be built consistently, so 50,000 a year, which will alleviate things quite a bit. I mean, housing is completely broken. That's the problem with the system we have. Like, it's a marketized system, whereas housing can never be viewed as a financial asset. We know that on the one hand, people are struggling to keep a roof over their head. And on the other hand, there are really wealthy investors who are making huge amounts of profit from buying homes. So that's the biggest part of our kind of strategy. But of course, we want to get rid of negative gearing and capital gains tax discounts, which really fuel the housing market. And that can have an immediate effect on actually the price of housing. But we have really strong policies on renting as well. We know that 30% of people in Australia rent now. So it doesn't matter whether you rent or you own a house or you're trying to, you know, purchase a house. Everyone needs a roof over their heads. So really strong renters' rights standards, which get rid of no grounds evictions, which have the option of long-term leases for people. So people can live in a rental property as if it's their own home. You know, I grew up in Pakistan, as most people know, and I think I lived in 2 houses, really, in my whole life there. I came to Australia, and I think I moved 5 times in the first 5 years of living here. And, of course, things have gotten even worse in terms of renting. So, for me, this is one of the key kind of cost of living issues, but also without a home and a secure place to call home, nothing else in your life can work, really. You need a secure, safe, accessible, you know, affordable place. And then you can move forward with, you know, your jobs, your you know, mental health, all of that is dependent on first and foremost having a home.
Yeah. You're tuned into Backchat on FBI 94.5. Right now, we're joined by Maureen Faruqi, the Green Senator for New South Wales, chatting about the party's policies for the upcoming federal election. We expect that the Greens will have a greater primary vote this year. As the party grows, what's to stop it from becoming like the coalition with the party picking who will represent the community based on factional and ideological views and moving people into suburbs just so they can be eligible to stand for election there?
Well, I think the difference between Greens and the other parties is that we have a really strong principle upon which the party was actually set up, which is grassroots democracy. So it is our members that decide at the end of the day who will become a candidate, who they are the ones who primarily advise us on policies. It's a consensus decision-making process through the members. And, you know, when I joined the Greens, I knew about this process, but, and, you know, basically I joined the Greens, and that was about 16 years ago now, in National Party Heartland in Port Macquarie. It was about, you know, our party's propensity to take up really bold positions on things that no one else was willing to do. For example, you know, for on refugees or so many other things. Even now on wiping student debt, is the first time any party has committed to do that. And you know, start that conversation at the very least. And why I've stayed with the Greens is because of grassroots democracy. So I think that is the way to stop from, you know, parachuting candidates. And I must say, this election, I have been really disappointed, especially in terms of people of colour, when there have been people of colour in, you know, like Fowler. I cannot get past that, I have to say. You know, there was an incredible candidate who represents the community there, who is part of the community, and she was bypassed to parachute in someone who didn't even live in the community and did not really represent the community. I think all parties need to seriously consider how they are pre-selecting candidates and how we will improve diversity in our parliaments to represent people who live on our streets and suburbs. It is really our responsibility. It's not just going to happen on its own. It has to be a deliberate choice and a different choice to what political parties are making at the moment.
Thank you so much, Maureen, for taking the time to speak with us today at Backchat. We really appreciate it.
It's always a pleasure. I'm a huge fan. Thank you so much.
That was Senator from the Greens Party, Maureen Faruqi, taking us through their policies for the election on higher education, student debt and housing.
Don't go away, because up next we'll be chatting to protest organiser for last Friday's school strike for climate protest, Bailey Linton Simpkins. But before that, though, I'm going to spin this track from Queen G and Lady Lash. I know you're a fan, Senator Faruqi, of Queen G. This is Love for My Sisters. You're listening to FBI. Keep it locked.
Despite many high schoolers being too young to vote, this didn't stop thousands of them from making sure their voices for greater climate action were loud and clear in the upcoming elections. Last Friday, students were joined by unions, the Greens and university groups in the School Strike for Climate March through Sydney CBD.
During this week, we heard from Nadia from UNSW's Enviro Collective, who attended the protest, and this is what she had to say on the event.
It has been heartbreaking to continually see communities devastated due to extreme weather events like the recent floods. With the latest IPCC reports demonstrating the need for immediate action, the government's negligence and endorsement of Santos and projects like the Kurri Kurri gas plant is unbelievable. We want to see action now towards reducing emissions and a just transition in order to limit global warming as much as possible.
Backchat producer Justina Basta sat down with protest organiser Bailey Linton Simkin to talk about some of the messages that young people want to send to our government around climate change ahead of the elections.
I'm joined by Bailey Linton Simkin, 17-year-old organiser for the School Strike for Climate protest. Thanks for joining, Bailey. How's it going?
It's going well, thank you. How are you?
I'm good. Can you give me a quick rundown of what happened last Friday and what School Strike for Climate is all about?
Yeah, sure. So last Friday we had a brief protest at the town hall, and then we marched to the Liberal headquarters on Macquarie Street, and had a rally outside of their headquarters as well. There were a few thousand people, maybe 5,000 people, but yeah, it was a great day. And School Strike for Climate kind of exists to call on the government for more action on the climate crisis, but then it focuses on climate justice as well, so the people who are affected by the climate crisis.
Although most people that attended, like yourself, are too young to have a say in the upcoming elections, what were some of the key messages you guys wanted to put out there?
So the key messages for this election, it was designed to impact the election. The biggest one is vote climate. If you're voting, vote for your kids, for your grandkids, vote for anyone. Vote climate is our biggest takeaway that we wanted people to get from that rally. It's super important. This election, we've got 3 years, according to scientists, to kind of get on track. So it is really important that the next government we have takes climate change seriously. And the current government's just proven that that's not their interests. Scott Morrison next week is a keynote speaker at a gas and oil event. They're giving public money to companies like Santos. It's disgusting. These companies and this government don't care, and they're working together to destroy the future, which is scary.
Wow, 3 years. The government needs to chop, chop, chop. How do yourself and the students feel about government action? And I know you've touched on this, or perhaps inaction in the climate space.
I think what we've got is this really weird point in the climate crisis where we are lagging behind so much, but also we're being told that our government's acting. If you listen to their messages, they are acting on the climate crisis, they're doing all this amazing stuff, and if you believe them, I'm sorry, but you're being fed lies. So the government is like handing money, public money, to the fossil fuel industry. They've given money to Santos for a gas project, and all around the country, these are projects that are hurting First Nations people, and in the end of the day, they're hurting our future.
And like you mentioned before, Bailey, scientists are saying, you know, we have the next few years to avoid some pretty catastrophic climate impacts. What are some of your fears, especially as a young person, if our government doesn't make a change to the current climate crisis?
I think what we're starting to see, and what we have started to see over the past few years, are the early effects of the climate crisis, bushfires and floods, and other events like that. We're going to see that climate change fixed. Well, no, it's not, because if you look at when it's raining, it's not raining at the right times. It's not sunny at the right times. It's all these different events. You know, climate change is already impacting our weather. I think what's really scary is it's going to make these disasters that we do see every season a lot worse, and I don't know how we're going to manage, to be honest.
What changes are School Strike for Climate and those who attended the protest looking for from the government?
So we've got three major demands of the government, which is no new coal, oil or gas projects, which include the Pilliger coal seam gas project and the Karikari gas plant, 100% renewable energy generation and exports by 2030, and a just transition and job creation for all fossil fuel workers and their communities. That last point is for all the communities who are affected by climate change and that transition, and that's where the climate justice messaging comes in. So you can transition to renewable energies quickly, and you can hurt communities as well, and we want to make sure that everyone is protected and has a job as we transition, because the sooner that we get moving on the transition, the sooner, yeah, we can have some decent climate action in the country.
You're listening to Backchat on FBI Radio with Justina Basta. Thanks for joining us, Bailey.
Thank you very much for having me.
Big cheers to Bailey for sitting down with us this week.
And that's all we have time for on the show today. Thank you very much to our brilliant guests, Marian Faruqi and Bailey Linton Simpkins. We also want to give a big shout out to all those who texted in. Thank you so much. And a massive cheers, as always, to our brilliant producers, Justina Basta, Vanessa Lim, Emma Pham, and Eamon Snow.
This has been Backchat, your go-to wrap for the news and current affairs that matter to you most. We'll see you again next week at 9:30. But until then, stay tuned for Limbs Akimbo up now.
Backchat. News and current affairs on FBI 94.5.